Welcome to a special series of podcasts from the Center for Emerging Media. I'm Mark Steiner. As the final episode of the hit HBO series The Wire approaches, I'm sitting down with writers, actors, directors, and others who've been involved in the production of the show since it premiered in 2002. I'm asking them to share their experiences and to talk about what they think The Wire is all about, what lessons they think The Wire teaches us about America. One of the greatest things about The Wire is how real and raw it is, how it almost slavishly weaves truth into the fiction. Some of these are things only people familiar with Baltimore are able to pick up on, like when a former governor makes a cameo, or just how much the fictional mayor, Carchetti, resembles the real mayor, Martin O'Malley. But there are some things that even people familiar with Baltimore don't pick up on.
The reporter the Sun paper sent over? Not exactly Bob Woodward. Hell of a job, Bubs. But, you know, we need help tomorrow, waiting tables in the back room. If you don't like it, then I won't ask again.
That man with a Bronx accent is Brendan Walsh. He and his wife, Willa Bickham, run a soup kitchen called Viva House. It's part of the Catholic worker movement. They run it out of their own home and have been doing so for over 40 years. It's not a normal-looking soup kitchen. It isn't depressing or institutional. It's actually kind of beautiful. Artwork covers the walls, which are painted with warm and inviting colors. A gleaming piano sits against the wall.
Well, it's interesting. The Wire did come one time, other seasons. And I don't know why they looked at it, and then I guess they decided not to do it here. Too small or whatever. It didn't look like a soup kitchen. So, well, we told them, well, that was the point. We didn't want it to look like a soup kitchen. We wanted it to look like somebody's house, because this is a house. So we asked people, when people come in, like we'll try to sit whole families together. That's what they'd like to do. Or people who want to sit with somebody, that's what they'd like to do. So we have it broken into smaller spaces. And then we have music and flowers and stuff like that on the table. So we try to make it as family-like as you can. And so I guess that's one of the big differences between...
No floor florist in Roland Park gives us flowers each Tuesday. Like today we'll go pick up flowers. Gorgeous. I mean, last week we had more roses than we could give away. And then we give away the flowers at the end of the
On Thursday week. When we're not doing it, a family will... who's having a hard time at home? And then, you know, they get a whole bunch of flowers.
A soup kitchen that gives out beautiful flowers along with food? Who's ever heard of such a thing? It's clear that Brendan and Willa care about the people they serve. Along with the artwork and quilts that hang all over the wall are pictures of visitors who come to Viva House.
Jessica, you might enjoy here some of the people who come into the soup kitchen since this is an off day. There's nobody. Tuesday afternoons are afternoon with our grandchildren. We have little granddaughters. So this is people making the plates. We have about 100 volunteers that come and work to make plates and do all that. And then people come to eat. And this is our Stone of Hope. You might have seen it. Well, of course, you ran in so fast.
Oh, yeah, we invited you to go. That's been out there now. See, originally, we were going to make it a tombstone. And then we said, that's really too depressing. This was the year of the 353 murders. So rather than have it so depressing, we made it a Stone of Hope. So on the stone, it says, we will hew out of a mountain of despair a Stone of Hope. And so that's what's
Martin
out there.
King's speech in 1963.
And then this mural you see in the background, that's hanging out there. It's very clear. The world be saved by beauty from Dostoevsky.
The world be saved by beauty.
Yeah.
It's clear that Brendan and Willa are doing much more here than running a soup kitchen. They provide food, but what's crucial to them are the social and political issues that are dear to them to change our society.
But the main thing we do is you offer a sense of community. So when you come... we do as best we can to make this as nonviolent a place you can come as possible and try to make it as best we can completely different than the violence of Baltimore City. And so it's the way we envision the society could be, where people could treat one another as, you know, real people.
Brendan and Willa have been feeding their neighbors out of their house since the 1960s.
We've started this long before other people had soup kitchen, before there was this. We never wanted to do this. It took us 25 years to put a sign on the door. We just wanted to be neighbors, and we invite our neighbors in, and we had neighbors sleeping here in the
housing department gave us a hard time and said you can't have unrelated people living with you. What it was is the neighbors complained because we had black and white people living together. That'd be 68, 69, 70. This was a very white area. African-American people were on the other side of Baltimore Street, so it was very racially divided, as this city still is. So we chose to be here because we're on the boundary line. We knew we could have, or at least we thought we could have, people of different colors coming here. So eventually we did, and it's worked out very well. It's a perfect place to be. We chose to be here because it was the poorest white community in the city, and it was shortly after the assassination of Martin Luther King that we moved here, and we knew we should better be in a neighborhood that was a little integrated.
In the 40 years since they've moved to West Baltimore, Brendan and Willa have only seen things get worse.
Just 40 years ago is not, I mean, that's not long ago. There was treatment on demand. I mean, you think we've made progress. Well, we're not. We're going the opposite way with the poor, with our neighbors. Treatment on demand. So, for example, the guys who lived with us or came to the soup kitchen who were middle-aged or older alcoholics, they could check themselves into Spring Grove. When they hit bottom, when things were really bad, they could just go check in. I mean, there was no problem getting treatment. Nowadays, it's years before you get treatment. And there's a woman who came, was in the kitchen, a friend of mine who was here to eat on Thursday. And she was so thrilled she got into a treatment program. She got into a treatment program, and she was just glowing about it. And the people in the kitchen didn't pick up. I mean, they were, oh, how good, and everything. One day inpatient and 7 days outpatient treatment. No,
that's it. Yeah.
That's not going to work. I mean, you know, it's like, what are we doing?
The idea of the common good is gone, absolutely gone. The more and more we privatize, deregulate, and everything like that, the harder and harder it is. And even you know, tearing down public housing makes it harder and harder to organize people in desperate need of housing. And this isn't to say keep the high rises, as brutal as they were, but it does mean that when these people got thrown out and scattered, there's nobody there to help pick up. Well, where are you going now? And all your needs taken care of. What's happened in this neighborhood is that people double up, and all those vacant houses you show doesn't mean that there's nobody in them. It just means that, you know, the doors are kind of locked, but there's people coming in the back. And they've started cementing them up with cinder block, but people still get in.
Brendan and Willa have watched as vacant homes in their community increase. The population has plummeted. What happened?
But of course, in Baltimore, we've lost over 150,000 blue-collar jobs since I've been here. And they've lost, since 1950, a third of their population in the city. So you only get work here that you could, you know, support your family on if you got a college degree and you're in tourism, finance, or medicine. See, this neighborhood used to have Maryland Cup. We used to have Montgomery Ward, the biggest catalog store on the East Coast. We used to have, Coppers was here. A lot of light factory work, raincoats and stuff like that down the end of Mount Street. So it was a big difference. People would get up and going to work. Now, we have over 50% unemployed around here. And we don't see anything that's going to change with regard to education, or employment for people. And that's a hard thing to, you know, say.
Brendan says that the reason he appreciates The Wire is that in all of its 5 seasons, it has dealt with these issues. And that's why when they were asked to be part of season 5, they agreed. Though maybe they didn't quite understand what they signed up for.
We really had a good time. It was a lot of work. I mean, after they left, cleaning it up. But
Bubbles only scrubbed one pot.
Yeah, you only scrubbed one pot, by the way.
They had to have a whole bunch dirty.
You told us to make it really look like it's a really big freaking job, you know? And we did, like dummies. And then after he finished the pot, everybody left. So the next time we had to have pots, we had them all like one pot. Everything else looked like they were dirty, but they weren't dirty.
That's great.
There were some instances where Willa and Brendan were forced to depart from reality. And here's a scene where Willa tells a young mother to stop hitting her baby.
Stop crying. Don't grab stuff off my plate. Mommy's gonna whip you. Do you need some help here? Because we don't do that here. In our house, there's no hitting anyone, especially children. Do you understand me? I don't like that scene. I never liked that scene. They knew I didn't like the scene. And, I told Bill and all they didn't like it. So the scene that's happened before is that I'm usually working in charge of the kitchen and all. And so I can see what's going on here. And in this scene in The Wire, which has happened before, there's a woman sitting at this table closest to the kitchen. And she is... Hi, she's known to us, she's an addict, and she is berating her child for eating off her plate and uses the most profane language you can hear and slaps him, hits him. And at that point, I come in from the kitchen, which I would ordinarily do, and ask her, what's going on, can I help you? However, in the script, I wasn't allowed to sit down. I did, I tried to change it. And I sat down to... talk to the mother like any of us would do. You always maintain eye contact. You don't stand above somebody to tell them they can't do this here. So I sat down, cut. What are you doing? You see this tape on the floor? You stand there. And I said, but I'd rather sit. It doesn't go over too well. And then we did this late at night.
It started
8 o'clock.
During the daytime, actually.
Oh, it started, you know how long these scenes take. It started early. And then... they have twins, of course. The 18-month-old child was put back and forth and was upstairs in our living room and playing with our toys and all this kind of stuff during this. But by the time they did the scene, both twins were screaming. The mother was in the kitchen crying. This is like 4 feet away from me. So I did my best to humanize the scene, but it comes off as I'm very hard on her. Now, it will always be hard on somebody who hits their child and calls them these awful names, an 18-month-old child, for eating off her plate. But I wouldn't do it in that manner. So it's a very hard woman who portrays this scene, and that's not characteristic of me.
Once the line's been written, you have to say it that way. In the scene I was doing with Andre Bubbles, I tell him that we really need help working the tables in the back. But the line was waiting the tables. So I was trying to tell him, well, this is a Catholic worker house, so we'd probably say working the tables in the back. And I kept screwing it up. So Andre says, say it the way it's written or we'll never get out of here.
Well, he said a little more profane.
So that was yeah. You do have to say the lines,
yeah,
the way they're written. I mean,
oh, you know that.
Not a lot of ad-libbing. No ad-libbing.
No.
They don't like ad-libbing.
At the end of my scene, I mean, here you have this baby, just a mess. I mean, he's crying, tired. They didn't get a nap because they were here since about noon,
Yeah.
And crying and tired. So, of course, what would you do but put your hand on his shoulder and try to comfort him? Cut. What are you doing? Nope, don't touch the child. So.
See, and the real thing, when you have, like, a fight breaks out, you've got to get yourself in the middle of the two people. Right, you can't start grabbing people and taking a side or anything like that. So what Willow was doing was trying to sit down, so she sees the mother, eye to eye, and then say, first, can I help you? Can I hold your baby while you eat, or something like that.
Standing between somebody is the Gandhian principle of interposition, and so you try to anticipate. Worked all our lives for a world of nonviolence, and. So you anticipate what might happen. So I would have, as she raised her voice, I would have anticipated, because this has happened, that there's going to be trouble. And so...
And so it wasn't realistic that Willa would go in and do that, or anybody doing it, because, first of all, if you did that the way Willa did, the woman probably would have gotten ticked and maybe belted you. I mean, when you think about it. If you're high and,
Her line, her line was... The last line to me was to be delivered with a good eye fuck. That's what David Simon wrote in the script. That's his favorite word, they said.
In the end, Willa and Brendan believe in The Wire because The Wire stands for the same thing that they do. for the losers of the world, and the importance of their struggle.
There's a great, actually, article in These Times on the Wire. And it's, the guy pointed out in something that is more to the point, that what he liked best about it was stories of people who are struggling. Whether they're struggling for the good or the bad, they're all in a struggle. And then he says, but most of us lose all throughout our lives. So here's a quote from I.F. Stone.
And here's the quote. The only kinds of fights worth having are those you're going to lose, because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for somebody to win an important major fight 100 years hence, a lot of other people have got to be willing, for the sheer fun and joy of it, to go right ahead and fight, knowing you're going to lose. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it.
The quote you just heard came from the great crusading and muckraking journalist, I.F. Stone. You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're assisted by engineer Andrew Epic. And thanks to Clean Cuts, Music, and Sound Design for Studio Space. To learn and hear more, go to our website at marksteinerblog.wordpress.com or Google Mark Steiner Blog. And I'm Mark Steiner, the Center for Emerging Media.
The sunshine, 'cause everything is better in the summertime, summertime, and it's never too late to start the day over. It's never too late. Pick up the phone and call me. It's never too late.